Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. Over the next 60 minutes, you'll hear some of the top stories and features of the past week from our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. As China's new national security law took effect in Hong Kong Wednesday, lawmakers re-examined the U.S. relationship with China. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has the latest reaction from Capitol Hill.
The first arrests under the new security law, put into effect on the 23rd anniversary of the handover from British to Chinese rule. Under that agreement, Hong Kong was supposed to operate under a one-country, two-systems principle. U.S. officials say that is now effectively over.
Free Hong Kong was one of the world's most stable, prosperous, and dynamic cities. Now it will be just another communist-run city where its people will be subject to the party elite's whims.
The annual march marking the anniversary of the handover now has very different implications because of the new law, which the U.S. and other Western nations say curbs freedoms, including the right to assembly and free speech.
Normally, this anniversary would have occasioned peaceful demonstrations. Instead, the new law has brought scores of arrests and boasts from local authorities about how many peaceful demonstrators they've jailed. New harsh penalties for Hong Kongers for new and vague offenses. New authorities for Beijing to intervene at will.
Ambiguities in the law, which was passed in secret without the input from Hong Kong authorities, concerns U.S. lawmakers.
Is it retroactive? Do they go back to any flying of the flags or making of statements? Or is it from now forward, which would be horrible enough? But that is a fear that I have.
Lawmakers also concerned suspects under the new restrictions could be forced to stand trial in mainland China.
We need to watch very carefully what happens next, particularly against groups and individuals who I'm pretty sure the Chinese government will target to make an example of in the early days after the passage of that bill.
The broad outlines of the law are already enough reason for concern, one analyst told Congress.
The extensive involvement of China's central security officials in the enforcement of this law is particularly worrying when we combine it with the broadly defined offenses.
The U.S. Senate unanimously passed a bill last week sanctioning officials, banks, and other entities who enable the new law. And more action is possible.
I think you'll see additional responses by Congress in terms of sanctions to try to convince the Chinese Communist Party that the cost is too high. They need to reconsider.
But Democratic lawmakers say that U.S. leverage over China has decreased during the Trump administration.
At the end of the day, it's the White House that sets policy. And I fear that our policy has gone astray, perhaps emboldening China.
Lawmakers say the people of Hong Kong can count on the support of America.
This is a battle between democracy and dictatorship, between liberty and tyranny, and between freedom and oppression. And it is a battle that the world must win.
Congress is moving quickly to pass a sanctions bill into law. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
Reports President Trump was briefed on Russian bounties awarded to the Taliban for the death of U.S. troops in Afghanistan continue to wave through Washington. U.S. lawmakers are pushing for answers after the White House said the president was not aware of that intelligence because it said it had not been verified. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
U.S. troops targeted in Afghanistan by Russia. That New York Times reporting still unsettling lawmakers on both sides of the aisle.
Senator from Illinois.
Richard. At issue, was the intelligence verified? And did President Trump see it?
The president was never briefed on this. This intelligence still has not been verified, and there is no consensus among the intelligence community.
A handful of Senate Republicans briefed on that intelligence Tuesday also cast doubts on those news media reports.
You know, the evidence that I have seen and have heard shows no corroboration between what was posted in the New York Times article. So that is very concerning.
But new reporting asserts President Trump did receive a briefing on that intelligence earlier this year. Democrats coming out of their own White House briefing Tuesday said they were concerned.
Nothing in the briefing that we have just received led me to believe it is a hoax. There may be different judgments as to the level of credibility, but there was no assertion that the information we had was a hoax.
Trump's relationship with Putin has always been a major concern for Democrats. They pointed out the president should have been made aware of such a serious security threat.
You don't deprive the president of information he needs to keep the troops safe because you don't have it signed, sealed, and delivered. I would certainly put this in the category that if you're going to be on the phone with Vladimir Putin, this is something you ought to know.
Russia has denied reports of the bounties. Republicans casting doubt on that assertion, even while saying the intelligence was not verified.
But would I be surprised if the Russians were doing something like this? Absolutely not. They are trying to create a problem for us everywhere. They particularly want us out of Syria and out of Afghanistan.
The White House alleges the New York Times report endangered national security. But Democrats have called on the president to take responsibility for the safety of U.S. troops.
Instead of dithering about what he knew, what he didn't know, he should be talking. He should have a plan. What are we doing? And above all, go after Putin.
Top congressional leaders and the heads of the Senate and House Intelligence Committees will have the opportunity to ask more questions Wednesday when they will head to the White House for a briefing. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. I'm Jim Stevenson. Parts of Australia's second biggest city, Melbourne, are to get back into COVID-19 lockdown following a surge in cases. Authorities have said 36 suburbs have had an unacceptably high number of new infections detected within the past few days. Australia so far has had more than 7,800 confirmed coronavirus cases and 104 people have died. Phil Mercer tells us more from Sydney.
With 73 infections, Victoria has accounted for almost all of the national tally of new COVID-19 cases in the past 24 hours. Failures in the hotel quarantine program are being blamed. Travellers returning to Australia from overseas face a mandatory 14 days in isolation. The state government has said that breaches in security have been linked to the spread of the disease in parts of Melbourne. Health officials have said the surge in infections was heartbreaking. More than 300,000 people will face legally enforceable restrictions on their movement as dozens of suburbs are once again placed into lockdown. The Victoria Premier Daniel Andrews is warning that the pandemic won't be over for a long time and says strict lockdown measures are needed.
The Chief Health Officer has advised me to reimpose restrictions. So they will be stay-at-home orders and they will run for 4 weeks. There will only be four reasons that you are permitted to leave your house and only if you really have to. For work or school, for care or caregiving, for daily exercise, for food and other essentials.
Fines of about $1,000 could be imposed if residents leave their homes without good reason. They're also banned from travelling to neighbouring New South Wales. Anyone from a virus hotspot in Melbourne who tries to cross the border in defiance of public health orders could face a fine of almost $7,500 or up to 6 months in prison. Disease control measures in New South Wales are being eased. Museums, libraries and some cinemas can now reopen, while more passengers are allowed on public transport. Queensland is also planning to reopen its borders to other Australian jurisdictions in 10 days' time, although travellers from Victoria will face restrictions. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
In India, anti-Chinese sentiment has escalated sharply since the worst violence in 50 years between the Asian rivals along their disputed border led to a military standoff. The crisis is expected to impact the trade relationship between Asia's two biggest countries as the Indian government considers measures to pressure Beijing. But as Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi, India has limited economic leverage against China's bigger economy.
scenes of protesters setting Chinese-made goods on fire and calls to boycott Chinese products have resonated across India since 20 Indian soldiers were killed in mid-June in a clash with Chinese troops. In its strongest retaliation against Beijing, the New Delhi government has banned 59 mostly Chinese apps, such as the hugely popular TikTok. The move will hurt the access of Chinese companies to millions of young Indians. A prominent Indian traders organization has called on shops to replace a range of Chinese goods on their shelves over the next 18 months.
Within this time frame, we have set a target of reducing the imports from China to the extent of $13 billion.
Anti-Chinese sentiment that was simmering since the coronavirus pandemic has flared in India after territorial disputes fueled a military standoff. But it may not be easy for New Delhi to wean itself away from its second biggest trading partner. Chinese-made goods are everywhere, from the toys that parents buy for their children to the smartphones in the hands of most adults.
I will have to remove about 40 to 50% of my stock if I have to keep only Indian goods.
India's biggest industries, such as automobiles, electronics, and pharmaceuticals, also depend heavily on Chinese components. Analysts say finding alternate suppliers would be a struggle.
All this is coming at a wrong time because, the industry is unable to get up after being hit by the pandemic. And if they, on top of the problems that they have, if they start facing supply constraints, supply bottlenecks, then, the Indian industry is just never going to get up from this, the shock that it has received now.
However, India is looking to reduce dependence on China. Railways and public sector companies have reportedly been asked not to give new contracts to Chinese companies. Efforts are on to boost domestic manufacturing, but the process will be slow.
We can expect something to change in the medium term, but not certainly in the short run.
Consumers agree. They say they can give up Chinese products only when they have a choice.
Be self-reliant, be bold, and yes, if anybody is supporting a sentiment that we don't need to use Chinese, please don't. But will it help? No. Use it and have a parallel option ready. Then we can throw it, maybe in a decade.
Protests like these, amid their ongoing border disputes, could eventually hurt the $90 billion trade relationship between Asia's biggest countries. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello anytime you're online or on your smartphone. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime.
Now on VOA Asia Weekend, the death of African Americans while in police custody and the ongoing protests demanding racial justice have had a major impact on most Americans, including immigrants, many of whom have had experience with racism. VOA's Valya Barupci spoke with some Indonesian Americans who talked about what they have endured.
Hey everybody.
Sinta Panyami Storms was among the protesters marching in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania recently to demand justice for George Floyd, the African American man whose death in police custody sparked demonstrations around the country. For Storms, the Black Lives Matter cause is personal since her husband is African American.
Buat keluarga kami,
for our family with Indonesian black children who look black physically, we have to have the conversation with them.
We have to have a conversation with them.
When you go out, you have to be careful because of the color of your skin.
Because of the skin, you know, the color of your skin.
Storms began to worry about her children's safety after Trayvon Martin's death in Florida in 2012. The black teenager shooter was eventually acquitted. She related to the incident when her other child, a son who is also biracial, got stopped by police.
When one of my kids was stopped by police, he was so scared. He peed his pants. He was scared and thought he would die.
It might not be personal for him, but Yusuf Arifin, another young Indonesian-American, is also passionate about racial justice. The West Covina, California native is actively engaged in Black Lives Matter rallies.
People are chanting Black Lives Matter because Black lives have not mattered. If you see at the rate of arrests, you see that cops are arresting way more Black people than they are white people. So there is a large injustice that's happening.
Racial prejudice is still felt by immigrant communities in U.S., including Asian Americans. This is evident in meetings, now done virtually, that Sinta Storms holds with other multiracial families with Indonesian ties and African Americans. They exchange experiences, including unpleasant ones, among fellow Indonesian immigrants.
Your man is really handsome, huh, for a Black guy.
One of those who joined the virtual meeting was Curtis Johnson. Johnson is an African-American man who worked in Indonesia but had to return to the U.S. following the COVID-19 pandemic. He says such discussions are important.
Continue to speak up. People are not only looking at the United States, but they are also looking, you know, in their own backyard. We see what's happening in the United States. How do we ensure it doesn't either continue or happen here in Indonesia?
For many people, the fight for justice doesn't end when the protests end.
This is my life.
And difficult conversations begin at home. Valdia Baraputri, VOA News, Washington.
What do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
How to stay healthy. Wash your hands with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. Scrub thoroughly for 20 seconds. If you cannot wash your hands, use a hand sanitizer. Taking these steps can prevent not only coronavirus, but also colds and flu and other viruses.
With many of the top stories from the past week, we continue now with VOA Asia Weekend. Food delivery services are beginning to get backed up, with long orders and now many in New York worried that they won't be able to get certain items for a long time. As a result, some have started to grow gardens on the rooftops of their homes. Dmitry Vishninin has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
Lucy Lesser has never liked vegetables. Tomatoes, broccoli, salad, none of that was for her.
I actually grew up my entire life thinking that tomatoes were absolutely disgusting, mostly because I was, you know, getting mushy, kind of unflavorful ones. And once I finally tasted like a homegrown tomato, I was like, oh my gosh, this tastes amazing.
Now that the coronavirus pandemic is making it harder to get fresh produce, Lesser is relishing the garden she has created in her apartment. Every square centimeter is used for some agricultural purpose, be it growing sprouts or lettuce. And her backyard is a vegetarian's dream. Rows of kale and garlic grow alongside strawberries, mint, and other herbs. She even has a fig tree.
Lavender. There's peppermint. More strawberries.
Like many others, Lesser lost her job due to the coronavirus outbreak. Since mid-March, she's been setting sprouts in little cardboard boxes outside her home, offering them for free. On the first day, people took 150 of them. In a week, that number doubled. She's hoping her neighbors will use them to start gardens and stay home more.
I'm trying to think of ways to help other people do that. I think right now, it feels like going to a supermarket, even if they have all the food you want to buy, nobody wants to be exposed to this virus, and I think staying home as much as possible is key. So I think people are also looking for ways to be self-sufficient. I've gotten messages from people who are starting roof gardens, who are starting cooperative gardens with their buildings.
I like to grow a lot of herbs because they're generally pretty expensive if you buy them, and they're good to stretch your meals and make things taste better, you know. Tomatoes are easy to grow. Peppers are easy to grow.
Marcel Van Ooyen is CEO of the nonprofit called Grow New York City. For three decades, it's encouraged New Yorkers to grow their own gardens. The group used to turn abandoned parking lots into gardens, but today, volunteers spend much of their time delivering vegetables to those in need.
Thousands of boxes into communities that are really hard hit. where people are, you know, having difficulty accessing produce and also are suffering economically and can't afford to buy their own.
Andrew Faust, owner of the Center for Bioregional Living, teaches people to live in harmony with nature. His center, located in the north of New York City, grows a variety of organic fruits and vegetables. He says that the pandemic brought to light the many mistakes in planning.
You want to have food banks, places where they've thought about, like, many, you know, at least many months, ideally, at the very minimum a month or two, of food for people within a certain neighborhood radius.
A concrete New York City skyline is getting a bit of green thanks to vegetable patches that have now claimed their place amid lounging chairs and sun umbrellas. For Dmitry Vershinin in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Despite the fact that states are one by one easing out of the lockdown, fashion retail stores face a serious challenge, the inability to sell merchandise that has been sitting on the shelves for months. Online sales of apparel are happening all the time, but due to the lowered purchasing capacity, the stores cannot make up the losses. Karina Bafrigian has the story.
The spring of 2020 has proven disastrous for hundreds of fashion retail stores, as sales fell by 90%, according to Reuters. And online sales cannot make up for the lost income, experts say. But some small stores are finding some creative ways to start in business.
We hold on to our inventory a lot longer than, you know, the big chains do, because our products are special, exclusive. Sometimes it takes us a year or more to sell through the inventory on an item.
It is still not clear when fashion retail stores can go back to operating on the pre-pandemic level. In the states that are gradually easing out of the lockdown, stores are opening every day with lower capacity and mandatory temperature checks. In a lot of them, fitting rooms continue to be closed.
It's nervous optimism. You know, we're opening for curbside. We don't know what that means necessarily, if everybody's just going to start calling in immediately, but we're excited because it shows that progress is happening.
Experts say that when the majority of fashion retail stores do reopen, they will start with big sales, this time not just online, but also in store. Karina Befredjian for VOA News, Washington.
What do a turtle, a gecko, and a set of gerbils have in common? They all have their own private, custom-designed art museum. VOA's Julie Tabo has more.
A video of gerbils enjoying their own personal art museum in Britain has inspired pet lovers around the world. Texan Jill Young is owner of a crested gecko named the Mayor.
I was on Twitter and I saw someone made a museum for their gerbil, and I thought that was adorable. And I have a gecko, and I figured, you know, reptiles need art too. So I decided to make him a little tiny museum that he could enjoy and climb on the walls.
It was a fun way to ward off boredom, she says.
I'm isolating because of the pandemic, and I didn't have much to do, so I figured I'd have some fun with my gecko, who's isolating with me.
Young made the museum out of an old cardboard box and used everyday items for the inside.
I used toothpicks and yarn for the little velvet rope, and then I used 2x2 mini canvases for the pieces of art themselves.
Both the gerbils and the mayor enjoy creations inspired by classic works of art, such as Vermeer's Girl with a Pearl Earring, Munch's The Scream, The Birth of Venus by Botticelli, and Grant Wood's American Gothic.
I chose a couple pieces that I find fun and memorable and instantly recognizable.
Young says her gecko seems to enjoy the exhibit.
So the mayor actually changes color. He goes from sort of a light tan to this really fired up orange color. And when I let him explore the artworks, he seemed pretty inspired by my bright color choices, and he turned a pretty bright orange. So I think that means he likes it in his own way.
It'll be interesting to see what other artistic venues these creative pet owners will come up with in the future. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. There's much more right after this.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
We're back with more VOA Asia Weekend. U.S. lawmakers called for an immediate investigation into news reports that Russia had offered bounties to Taliban-backed militants for the deaths of U.S. troops in Afghanistan. The White House has denied reports U.S. President Donald Trump had been briefed on those bounties, saying they had not been fully verified by the U.S. intelligence community. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more on the fallout in Washington.
A Russian military unit offered money to Taliban-backed militants as a reward for the deaths of U.S. troops in Afghanistan. That U.S. intelligence community finding reached President Trump, according to a New York Times story. The White House called the Times report false.
There was not a consensus among the intelligence community. And in fact, there were dissenting opinions within the intelligence community, and it would not be elevated to the president until it was verified.
That follows the president's Sunday tweet denying any knowledge of that intelligence, a position Senate Democrats say is inexcusable.
President Trump, you lose either way. If you weren't briefed on this important report, how can you run an administration where something this important is not brought to your level? And if you were told about the report and did nothing, that's even worse. Shame on you. Shame on you.
Congressional Republicans are also asking why the president was not briefed and called on Trump to take the allegations seriously. Democrats saying it's further proof Trump is not tough enough on Russian President Vladimir Putin.
The president is saying that he did not know of this. But where is the outrage from him that he didn't know about this? Where is his questioning and demands for information if we take this at face value? It is another example of this unusual hold that Putin has on this president.
The White House is pushing back on that criticism.
This president has been extremely strong on Russia, imposing sanctions on hundreds of Russian individuals, expelling dozens of diplomats, closing two Russian consulates, withdrawing from an INF treaty, and several other actions.
Both Russia and the Taliban have denied that bounties were offered, but the New York Times report was confirmed by British intelligence. Schumer and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi have called for all members of Congress to receive a full briefing on the intelligence and how much the president knew. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to VOA Asia. Frontline medical workers at a Maryland intensive care unit say the coronavirus pandemic is far from being over. More than 30 U.S. states have reported case number surges after taking steps to reopen. And this comes as cases worldwide surpass the 10 million mark and more than 500,000 people have died. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo reports.
The Fort Washington Medical Center in the state of Maryland went from 4 ICU beds at the start of the pandemic to 16 ICU units as it quickly became a hotspot for the virus during the early days of the crisis. Kevin Cole, a respiratory therapist at Fort Washington who also has asthma, says he knows the anxiety and fear coronavirus patients experience when they can't breathe. And it's hard for him to understand the sudden return of crowded public places when it's hard to social distance.
I see patients, unfortunately, dying from this virus every day. Everybody is out lounging on the beaches and just thinking that it's over, and it's not. It's far from being over. Yeah. And unfortunately, there's those people that will keep this pandemic going.
After taking steps to reopen, 31 states are now seeing surges in new coronavirus cases, including new hotspots of Arizona, Texas, and Florida. With more than 8,500 new confirmed cases of COVID-19 and 29 deaths reported on Sunday, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said that interactions among young people are driving the surge in confirmed cases.
Our median age of new case began in the 60s in March. For most of the pandemic in April and May was in the low 50s. Now, this week, half the cases are in their early 30s or below.
Back in Maryland, registered nurse Trakina Hogan says seeing colleagues put on full sets of personal protective equipment required to enter rooms with COVID-positive patients is a constant reminder of how easily the virus can spread.
This is a real thing, and it's not fake. It is definitely one that we need to take serious precautions on. Keep our masks on, keep our hands washed.
A message echoed by her colleagues and medical staff all over the country. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
Now on VOA Asia, U.S. corporations are responding to a wave of protests over the recent death of George Floyd, a black man who died while in police custody, with pledges to increase diversity, donations to civil rights groups, and in some cases, changes in company policies long sought by critics. VOA's Julie Tabo tells us more.
I have resigned as a member of the Reddit board. I have urged them to fill my seat with a black candidate.
Alexis Ohanian is married to tennis star Serena Williams, who is black. But even without that personal connection, many in the corporate world are saying black lives matter.
I'm saying this as a father who needs to be able to answer his black daughter when she asks, "What did you do?"
Out of the 500 largest U.S. companies, there are just four black CEOs, says Fortune, which ranks America's largest companies.
No justice, no peace.
Amid global protests, more corporations are now pledging to put their money where their mouth is. Apple is increasing spending with black-owned suppliers. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg announced in a Facebook post that his company will be donating an additional $10 million to groups working on racial justice. Google CEO Sundar Pichai wrote that the company would give $12 million to organizations working to address racial inequalities. YouTube said it will use $100 million to fund black content creators. In early June, Amazon announced that it will donate $10 million to organizations supporting justice and equity. The world's largest online retailer has also frozen police use of its facial recognition technology, which critics have said is more likely to misidentify people with dark skin. And NASCAR, prompted by its only black driver, has banned the Confederate flag, a symbol of white segregationists, at its racetracks and events. It's been unusual in the past for big brands to embrace activism for fear of alienating customers. Now, it seems, many see it as a greater risk to not take a stand. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
After you listen to VOA Asia, you can see VOA Asia. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free. See us often at VOA Asia YouTube.
LGBT performers thrive in Vietnam, while garment makers in Bangladesh stitch together protective gear for the world. These are the topics on today's VOA Asia Business Scene with Ira Melman.
Nam Vai is one of hundreds of LGBT performers in Vietnam who have found confidence and a way to earn a living through lotto shows, a form of entertainment dating back to the French colonial era and now wildly popular in the South. Like many sexual and gender minority people in Vietnam, the 26-year-old has faced stigma and discrimination for much of her life, despite a gradual change in social attitudes in the communist state.
The LGBT group cannot have jobs that are considered high in society because we suffer from discrimination right since we were at school, so we didn't have much motivation to continue with our studies. There are some with high education, but not many.
Up until the 1990s, such performances were a regular part of rural life in the South, but their appeal began to fade until Saigon Tantoy burst onto the mainstream nightlife circuit in 2017. Vietnam is seen as relatively progressive on LGBT issues. The one-party state lifted the ban on same-sex marriage in 2015, although it stopped short of full legal recognition for the unions, and a long-promised transgender law to allow legal gender changes has not yet materialized. Much of the audience at the shows in Ho Chi Minh City and next door of Binh Duong province is young and view the rainbow of swishing gowns through their phone screen. Facing ruin as orders from Western brands collapsed in the coronavirus pandemic, many Bangladeshi garment factories have been given a lifeline with orders to make protective masks, gloves, and gowns for export. Nonetheless, hundreds of thousands of workers who used to work in export-oriented apparel factories in the South Asian country remain jobless despite the new orders and some recovery in Western markets. At factories in the industrial town of Sabar, just north of Dhaka, thousands of workers are now working 8-hour shifts, 6 days a week, making personal protective equipment. On the factory floor, sewing machines operated by hundreds of workers whirled loudly beside huge stacks of white and light blue gowns.
I lost my job at my previous workplace. When I heard Bexumco Group was opening this PPE making hub, I came and I joined here.
Bexumco, a major supplier to the owners of brands like Zara, Calvin Klein, and Tommy Hilfiger, last month exported 6.5 million medical gowns to U.S. brand Hanes, and it expects to export some $250 million worth of protective gear this year.
I feel lucky for getting work in this factory, while many others lost jobs, now facing difficulties living. At least I can feed my family and parents.
Sumaya Akhtar and Ruba Mayab, who lost their jobs making apparel for Western retailers, were among the workers making final adjustments to the clothing. For Business Scene, I'm Ira Melman.
Coronavirus questions. Can the virus be spread by mosquito bites? Is there a vaccine or medication that prevents it? Is there any medicine that cures it? The answer to all of the questions is no. The best steps to take: wash your hands, cover your cough, stay at home if you are sick or advised to by local authorities.
VOA Asia continues. As you're probably well aware, locking down at home is one of the strategies that authorities in the United States and elsewhere have relied on to reduce the spread of COVID-19. But how does that work for almost 600,000 people who are homeless in the United States? VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias went to the streets and shelters of Washington, D.C. to get a first-hand look.
A. Addison doesn't look like your typical homeless person. He was once a counselor for teenagers in trouble, but these days he lives on the streets after falling on hard times.
The toll it takes on the body physically, psychologically and emotionally, having to get back and forth just to get breakfast, lunch, dinner, clothing, shelter.
And now there is COVID-19.
Not having cleaning agents or disinfectants in spaces, regardless of where it is, I think opens up the potential for people to get the infection.
Alexson is one of nearly 600,000 homeless people in the United States, based on the most recent official count. In a pandemic, they are at special risk. Of the 527 COVID-19 deaths in Washington, 20 were homeless people. As a group, their risk of death is about double that of the overall population.
As folks come in and as we do checks throughout the day, if folks say that they're feeling symptomatic, we'll take them out of the population of the shelters, and we'll bring them to one of our isolation and quarantine sites, and we'll test them there. If that comes back positive, then we'll go back and we'll find the close contacts for that person and also ask them to come into our isolation and quarantine as well.
Around the country, officials had to stop shelters from becoming a breeding ground.
about a couple weeks into the pandemic, people quickly realized that it was spreading inside shelters very, very, very fast. And a lot of the focus was to do what we call deconcentrate shelters. So they started moving people out of shelters into larger spaces. Some jurisdictions rented arenas and others did hotel rooms.
61-year-old Mary Montalvo lives in a nearby park. She gets food and hygiene products from local nonprofits and churches. But a new mask, that is tougher.
We try to give one, I'd say, every second or third day. But many of the people wear, lose them.
Where do you go if you need to wash your hands?
That's very difficult. I go inside the church here, but I have some cleanser that I carry in my jacket and I use that.
COVID-19 has made it harder for those like Michael Williams, who's looking for work. Day centers have adopted strict social distancing.
It takes extra long to get services you need because they only allow one person at a time. Without these spaces, it's kind of hard. I'm not able to apply for jobs. I can't get any income, and it's crazy.
U.S. unemployment is at a staggering 14%. A Columbia University study projects the homeless population may grow 40 to 45% this year.
I expect that if unemployment continues to stretch for a long period of time, that we will start to see decreases in rent payments and we will start to see evictions.
The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development has announced almost $3 billion in aid for homeless Americans and those at risk of losing housing. But that's just temporary.
In the capital, housing is really expensive. And so until we start addressing how to have steady employment that pays closer to the cost of housing, we're going to keep seeing this crisis of homelessness.
Mary Montalvo has been homeless 8 times in 20 years.
There's sufficient money within the United States to help the people who are homeless. It's just the distribution of those monies. The wealthy are getting wealthier and they're ignoring the poor.
For VOA News, Veronica Valderas Iglesias, Washington.
You're listening to VOA Asia. A Virginia NGO called Computer Corps helps low-income immigrants master using computers in order to help them find jobs. However, the coronavirus pandemic has made life hard for the organization because so few of the students have computers or internet connections at home. VOA's Maxime Moskalkov tells us more.
For more than 2 decades, the NGO called Computer Corps has been helping low-income immigrants master the internet and computers. According to Pew Research Center, in 2019, 4 in 10 U.S. families with less than $30,000 annual income didn't have a computer at home.
Our mission is to serve low-income adults who need basic computer skills to get a job.
The organization instructors have already helped more than 3,000 students learn how to use a computer. Computer course students come from over 90 different countries and speak more than 100 languages.
Our average age is around 45 or 50, so you get a lot of adults, whether they've been here 20 years, they might already have their citizenship. Some people have just come over, but you get a lot of adults who kind of missed the whole computer revolution for 20 years.
During quarantine, the group has had difficulty continuing to teach because most of their students did not have computers at home. So the group started giving them computers.
We started our sort of computer giveaway ministry where we started asking for donations to purchase low-cost refurbished computers off the internet and have them delivered and then meet with students individually wearing masks and gloves and hand them computers. And then when they get home, we work with them over the phone to help them learn how to set it up.
The result, the group was able to continue classes remotely. Among them, women who make up about 70% of the students at Computer Corps.
I knew how struggling and how hard it is to find a job and also to be proficient in computer skills. It's not easy nowadays to find a job if you don't know how to use even the basics. So doing this, just teaching our students and reaching out for people who are struggling, especially nowadays with what's going on. Coronavirus made things worse because a lot of our students, even the alumni, lost their jobs.
Karia El Ghosh came to the US from Lebanon in 1994. She has spent the last 25 years working in places where she did not need any computer skills, the last 2 years helping teachers at a daycare. It was her daughter who encouraged her to finally get acquainted with computers.
More comfortable, like going on computer, learn what is the structure of the computer, programming or filing a document. All this language was very hard for me to understand it. I used to type with one hand. Now I use my both hands.
Specialists say many people, especially the elderly, believe computer skills are more than they can handle. But Computer Core instructors, who themselves learned to use computers at the NGO, are a living example that once you overcome the initial fear, anything is possible. Maxim Moskalkov for VOA News, Washington.
Coronavirus infections are continuing to surge in the United States. Not since March has there been a spike like the numbers reported in June. VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports on how lawmakers, along with state and federal officials, are reacting to the grim news.
The advice of experts hasn't changed. Wear a mask in public, keep your distance, and wash your hands.
This is part of a process that we can be either part of the solution or part of the problem. If we don't extinguish the outbreak, sooner or later, even ones that are doing well are going to be vulnerable to the spread. So we need to take that into account because we are all in it together. And the only way we're going to end it is by ending it together.
The United States has 4% of the world's population, but accounts for one quarter of the more than 10 million confirmed cases of COVID-19. Cases in the state of Arkansas alone jumped nearly 25% this week. Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson calls for more testing.
We've doubled the amount of our testing nationally. We've got to double it again. That is probably the most important thing that we can do. And I'm concerned as a state, while we've increased our testing dramatically in Arkansas with the demand for testing from California and some of the high population states, how is our commercial providers going to keep up with that?
Hutchinson called for greater use of the Defense Production Act, which gives President Donald Trump emergency authority to control domestic industries like those that make protective gear. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said mandating the use of masks across the country is long overdue, something the Trump administration had not done.
The Centers for Disease Control has recommended the use of masks, but not required it because they don't want to offend the president. And the president should be example. You know, real men wear masks. Be an example to the country. And wear the mask. It's not about protecting yourself. It's about protecting others.
The president generally does not wear a mask in public. And at a recent campaign rally in Oklahoma, Trump blamed increased testing for the U.S.'s disproportionately high number of cases.
Testing is a double-edged sword. We've tested now 25 million people. Here's the bad part. When you do testing to that extent, you're going to find more people. You're going to find more cases. So I said to my people, slow the testing down, please.
The number of deaths nationally tops 125,000, and global fatalities are just shy of 500,000. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Recent polls show that U.S. President Donald Trump is losing support among older Americans who helped the Republican win election 4 years ago. Mike O'Sullivan reports on recent polling that is viewed as good news for his Democratic challenger, Joe Biden.
Touting his efforts to help older Americans, President Donald Trump announced a cap on insulin prices at a White House event in May.
That's a big deal. Participating plans will cap costs at just $35 a month.
In battleground U.S. states such as Florida and Arizona, seniors are a large part of the electorate, says former Democratic mayor of Tucson, Thomas Volge.
But even more importantly, people over 65 tend to turn out in larger numbers than any other group. So in that sense, it's not only the percentage of the public, but also the intensity with which they are likely to vote.
Polls have long shown that voters generally approve of Trump's handling of the economy. But civil disturbances, questions of racial justice, and the COVID-19 pandemic have contributed to a surge in the polls for Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden. Trump is trailing Biden among seniors slightly in one poll and by at least 8 points in two other surveys. The White House has called some recent polls misleading, but a pollster says there's a trend.
He is not moving. Not moving in the right direction, and you're looking at the clock ticking right now toward November.
Many seniors have made their decision, including this voter in Nebraska.
I want a president who cares more about the people who reside here than himself, his businesses, his money, and winning an election.
But other seniors are supporting the president.
He's the only politician so far I know. What he say during his campaign, he just execute his promise.
One New Yorker says he's looking for integrity and will vote for former Vice President Biden.
I think the man there right now has no clue what he's doing. It's whatever he comes up with in the morning.
Another senior and Trump supporter says Biden is not up to the job.
He doesn't really have the stamina, and he has a lot of baggage that he's carrying. I don't think he's done much as a politician for all the years that he's been in there.
Polls show an average 10-point overall lead for Biden, who's at roughly 50% in national polls.
When a challenger reaches a 50% point, losing the election becomes very, very difficult for him. And from all accounts, it looks like Biden has now reached the 50% point.
A lot could change in coming months, and the polls did not forecast Trump's eventual win in the 2016 presidential election. What will not change is how crucial older Americans will be to determining who wins in November. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Now on VOA Asia Weekend, the United Nations marked its founding in a much different world than it was born into. VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir looks at whether the United Nations is still fit for purpose 75 years on.
Now my duty, my honor and my privilege in the chair to call for a vote on the approval of the Charter of the United Nations.
It was June 1945 in San Francisco, California, that the UN Charter was signed. Created to prevent a repeat of the atrocities of World War II, the United Nations was designed as a framework to peacefully resolve international disputes. The organization marks its 75th anniversary in a much different world, one gripped by global upheaval, says UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
From COVID-19 to climate disruption, from racial injustice to rising inequalities, we are a world in turmoil. At the same time, we have an international community with an enduring vision embodied in the Charter to guide us to a better future. Our shared challenge is to rise to this moment.
But several of the UN's major founding powers, Britain, China, Russia, and the United States, are moving further away from one of its core principles— multilateralism. This, as smaller countries are embracing it.
We really see this move towards investing the UN with even more importance because these countries collectively acknowledge that many of the problems of our day cannot be solved except by multilateral diplomacy. Right? Things like climate change, things like global health, as we see too clearly today, can only be solved through international cooperation.
The UN chief acknowledges that today's multilateralism needs to be more robust.
The problem is not that multilateralism is not up to the challenges the world faces. The problem is that today's multilateralism lacks scale, ambition, and teeth.
Over the years, the UN has expanded its work to include peacekeeping and humanitarian operations. Today, the organization feeds 87 million people in 83 countries, vaccinates half the world's children, and has nearly 100,000 peacekeepers deployed in 13 countries. While preventing another world war, the UN has struggled to curb conflicts in nearly every corner of the globe, making the body ineffectual, say critics.
The UN isn't what it was conceived to be in 1945. It's been largely ineffective in its political arms. Many of its humanitarian agencies do very good work, but on the political side, it has not functioned as it was expected to.
The UN is marking its anniversary during the COVID-19 pandemic, a disease that poses perhaps its single greatest challenge since its founding. But before the virus, the UN was already facing a long to-do list.
I think the overwhelming challenge for the UN in the next decades will be coordinating international responses to climate change.
Equally challenging, finding ways to balance power among its strongest members so they will continue to cooperate and not paralyze the organization's work.
The single greatest challenge to the UN is the rise of China, because China is gaining influence in the UN very rapidly as its economy grows, but that leaves American officials nervous, and it leaves diplomats from other countries worried that they are losing their positions and their influence in the UN system.
The organization, which has a multi-billion dollar annual budget, is also facing the worst fiscal crisis in its history.
The UN is incredibly cash-strapped right now. And that has real-world consequences. It has programmatic consequences. It has consequences for peace and security. It has consequences for things like global health, as we see today.
As the UN looks ahead, it will need the unity and political will of its 193 member states to successfully tackle the many problems the world faces. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, New York.
Scientists at NASA are planning another launch to Mars later this summer. The U.S. Space Agency says it will send to the surface a rover they described as a robot scientist. Part of that mission will also be NASA's first attempt at flight on the Red Planet. VOA's Arash Arabasadi brings us up to date on the latest in space news.
Test helicopter inside NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab at the California Institute of Technology shows it can fly in an environment built to mimic conditions on Mars. Hovard Grip is chief pilot for the Ingenuity Mars helicopter and one of the architects of the algorithms that give it autonomous flight.
Once we've proven that it's possible to fly a helicopter in this environment, that sets the stage for future missions where we can use helicopters in useful capacities, for example, for reconnaissance or for doing independent science.
Initial tests were shaky at best, with testers flying Ingenuity by remote control in a vacuum with carbon dioxide.
It was a success in one sense in that it showed, yeah, it is possible to get off the ground with a helicopter, despite the thin atmosphere. But at the same time, it also showed us that we have to really focus intently on the control aspect of the helicopter, making sure that it's possible to handle a helicopter in this environment.
Scheduled for launch between July and August, Ingenuity joins a mission with Perseverance, the next generation rover to roam the Red Planet. NASA designed a $23 million toilet scheduled for September delivery to the International Space Station. It's a smaller design and should be more accommodating to female astronauts as well as future deep space missions. The space agency also announced a $20,000 Lunar Lou toilet building challenge running until August 17th. NASA seeks a toilet tailored to the moon's gravity, which differs from the microgravity in space. Finally, a partial solar eclipse called a ring of fire was visible from Hong Kong this week, with the moon covering close to 90% of the sun's diameter. Outside the Hong Kong Space Museum, stargazers with mostly makeshift eye protection turned up for the show.
I think it's incredible. I've never seen an eclipse in person like this before. I've only seen it live stream. But to see it in person, and some people lent me like glasses so I could look directly at the sun, was really, really nice.
There has not been a ring of fire eclipse for at least a century, with the next one not until 2039, and the next after that in the year 2392. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
This has been VOA Asia Weekend, a compilation of some of the stories presented throughout the past week on our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Check out VOA Asia online at voanews.com.